Elphaba remembered that the broom was given her by Mother Yackel. The young woman had seen the old Mont as crippled, senile, a bother, but now Elphaba looked back and wondered if there was more to her than met the eye. Was that broom magicked by Mother Yackel with a vestige of some cambrical instinct? Or did Noor have a power developing in her, and did she bring it out in the senseless broom? Noor apparently was a fervid believer in magic. Maybe the broom was waiting to be believed in. Would it fly for Elphaba, too? One night, when everyone else had retired, Elphaba brought the broom out to the courtyard. She felt a little foolish, crouching down on the broom like a child on a hobby horse. "Come on, fly, you fool thing," she muttered. The broom twitched back and forth in a naughty way, enough to raise welts in her inner thighs. "I'm not a blushing schoolgirl. Stop that nonsense," said Elphaba. The broom rose a foot and a half, and then dumped Elfie on her rear end. "I'll set you afire, and that'll be the end of you," said Elphaba. "I'm too old for this sort of indignity." It took 5 or 6 nights of trying before she managed even to hover 6 feet off the ground. She had been useless in sorcery. Was she doomed to be useless at everything? It was a pleasure, finally, to scare the barn owls and bats senseless, and it was good to be abroad. When she had more confidence, she wobbled far down the valley to the remains of the Ozma Regent's attempt at a dam. She rested and hoped that she wouldn't have to walk back. She didn't. The broom was resistant to her intention, but she could always threaten it with fire. She felt like a night angel. In midsummer, an Arjikit trader came along with pots and spoons and spools of thread, and he carried with him some letters left at an outpost farther north. Among them was a note from Frex. Apparently Nanny had told him of her intentions to hunt Elphaba down, and he wrote to the Monterey, which had forwarded the letter on to Kiamo Ko in the Vincus. Frex wrote that Nessa Rose had orchestrated a revolt, and that Munchkin Land, or most of it anyway, had seceded from Oz and set itself up as an independent state. Nessa Rose, as the eminent Throp, had become the political head of state. Frex apparently thought this was Elphaba's birthright, and that she should come to Colwyn Grounds and challenge her sister for it. "It may be she isn't the right woman for the job," he wrote, though Elphaba found his apprehension surprising. Wasn't Nessa Rose the warmly spiritual daughter that Elfie could never be? Elphaba had no thirst for leadership, and did not want to challenge Nessa Rose in any way. But now that the broom seemed able to carry her for long distances, she wondered if she could fly by night to Colwyn Grounds, and spend a few days seeing Papa, Nessie, and Shell once again. It had been 12 years since she left Nessie in Shiz, drunk and sobbing following the death of Amma Clutch. For Munchkin Land to be free of the wizard's iron grip, that alone would be worth the trip. It made Elfie grin a bit at herself to feel her old contempt for the wizard flare up. Perhaps this was what healing meant, after all. To be safe, one afternoon, Elphaba went through the soldiers' empty barracks. She pored through their papers. All the documents related to issues of mapping and geological survey, nothing else. There seemed to be no hidden agenda of threat to the Arjikis or the other Vincus tribes. The earlier she went, the sooner she would return, and it would be better if no one knew. So she told everyone she was taking a period of isolation in her tower, and she wanted neither food nor visitors for some days. When midnight struck, she set out for Colwyn Grounds, now the home of her powerful sister. She slept by daylight in the shadows of barns, the overhang of eaves, the lee of chimneys. She travelled by night. In the gloom, Oz spread out below. She hovered above it at about 80 feet, near as she could reckon. And the countryside made its geographical transformations with the ease of a vaudeville backdrop on rollers. The hardest passage was down the steep flanks of the Great Kells. Once free of the mountains, however, she saw Oz level out into the rich alluvial plain of the Gilliken River. She flew along the waterway, above trading vessels and islands, until it fed at last into Restwater, Oz's largest lake. She kept to its southern edge, and took a whole night to traverse it, as it endlessly lapped in black oily silk waves into sedge and swamp. She had trouble finding the mouth of the Munchkin River, which drained into Restwater from the eastern direction. Once she did, though, it was easy to locate the yellow brick road. The farmland beyond grew even more lush. The effects of the drought, so drastic in her childhood, had been eradicated, and dairy farms and small villages seemed to prosper, happy as a child's toy town set, cunning and cozy in the wrinkled, nappy land of arable soil and accommodating climate. The farther east she went, however, the more torn up the highway became. Crowbars had pried out bricks, trees had been felled, and brush walls erected. It looked as if a few of the smaller bridges had been dynamited. A safeguard against retaliation by the wizard's army? 7 days after leaving her chambers at Kiamo Ko, Elphaba flew into the hamlet of Colwyn Grounds and slept under a green bay tree. When she awoke, she asked a merchant for the great house, and he tremblingly pointed her the way, as if she were a demon. "So a green skin still gives Munchkinlanders the creeps," she observed, and walked the last couple of miles, and arrived at the front gates of Colwyn Grounds a little after breakfast. She had heard her mother speak of Colwyn Grounds wistfully and angrily, as they had slopped in waterproof boots through 6 inches of Quadling country water. Elfie's years in the smug antiquity of Shiz and the pomp of the Emerald City ought to have prepared her for an imposing mansion. But she was startled, even shocked, at the grandeur of Colwyn Grounds. The gate was gilded, the forecourt swept clean of every scrap of grass and dung, and a bank of topiary saints in terracotta pots lined the balcony above the massive front door. Dignitaries with ribbons denoting new rank and prestige in the free state of Munchkinland, she guessed, stood in small groups to one side. Coffee cups in hand, the officials had apparently just finished an early morning Privy Council meeting. Inside the gate, swordsmen stepped neatly up and barred her way. She began to protest, instantly branded a menace and a loon, she could see, and she was about to be ejected when a figure wandered into view from around the corner of a folly and called for them to stop. "Fabula," he said. "Yes, Papa, I'm here," she answered, with a child's politeness. She turned. The dignitaries paused in their discussions, and then resumed, as if realizing that overhearing this reunion would be the height of rudeness. The guards withdrew their barrier when Frex approached. His hair was thin and long, and caught up by a rawhide implement, as it always had been. His beard was the color of cream, and reached his waist when he took his hands away from it. "This is the Sister of the Eminence of the East," said Frex, staring at Elphaba, "and my oldest daughter. Let her pass through, dear men, now and every time she approaches." He reached and caught her hand, and turned his head as a bird might to see her through one capable eye. The other eye, she realized, was dead. "Come, we will greet each other in private, away from this attention," said Frex. "My word, Fabula, you have become your mother in these long years." He linked his arm into hers, and they went into the building through a side door and found a small salon done up in saffron silks and plum velvet cushions. The door closed behind them. Frex lowered himself cautiously to the sofa and patted the upholstery next to him. She sat down, weary, tired, astonished at the wealth of her own feeling for him. She was full of need, but she reminded herself, "You're a grown woman." "I knew you would come if I wrote," he said. "Fabula, I always knew that." He wrapped her in his arms stiffly. "I may cry for a minute." When he was through, he asked her where she had gone and what she had done and why she had never come back. "I was not sure there was a back to come to," she answered, realizing the truth of it as she spoke. "When you finished converting a town, Papa, you moved on to new fields. Your home was in the pasture of souls. Mine never was. Besides, I had my own work to do," she added a moment later in a low voice, "or I thought I did." She mentioned her years in the Emerald City, but did not say why. "And was Nanny right? Were you a Mont? I didn't raise you for such submission," he said. "I'm surprised. Such conformity and obedience." "I was no more a Mont than I ever was a Unionist," she chided him gently. "But I lived with the Monts. They did good work, whatever the error or inspiration of their beliefs. It was a time of recuperation from a difficult passage. And then last year I went to the Vincas, and I guess I've made my home there, although for how long I cannot say." "And what do you do?" he said. "Are you married?" "I'm a witch," she answered. He recoiled, peered through the working eye to see if she spoke in jest. "Tell me about Nessie before I see her, and Shell," she said. "Your letter sounded as if you thought she needed help. I'll do what I can in the short while I can be here." He told her about her sister's rise to eminence and the secession in the late spring. "Yes, yes, I know of it, but not why," she said, prodding. So he described the burning of a grange where opposition meetings had been gathering, the reported rape of a couple of Munchkinlander maidens following a cotillion of the wizard's army garrisoned near Dragon Cupboard. He mentioned the massacre at Far Applerue and the heavy taxation on farm crops. "The last straw," he said, "as far as Nessie was concerned anyway, was the callow despoiling by the wizard soldiers of simple country meeting houses." "Unlikely last straw," said Elphaba. "Isn't the back room of a colliery as holy a place to pray as a meeting house? I mean, according to teaching." "Well, teaching," said Frex. He shrugged. Such distinctions were beyond him now. "Nessie was incensed and communicated her outrage, and before she knew it, the spark had been thrown out and the tinder caught. Within a week of her firing off a furious letter to the Emperor Wizard himself, a dangerous and seditious act, the revolutionary fever had coalesced around her. It happened right here in the forecourt of Colwyn Grounds. It was magnificent, and you'd have guessed Nessie was groomed for treason. She addressed the senior men among the farming communities, both near and far, and kept her religious agenda in check, sensibly, I think. So her appeal for their support was overwhelmingly answered. There was a unanimous approval for secession." "Papa's gone pragmatic in his old age," Elphaba observed with some surprise. "But how did you slip through the border patrols?" he asked. "Things being what they are, hotting up, as they say."
"I just flew right through, a little black bird at night-time," she answered, smiling at him and touching his hand. It was glazed and mottled pink, like a lake lobster on the boil.
"But what I don't know, Papa, is why you called me here. What do you expect me to do?"
"I had thought you might join your sister in her seat of authority," he said, with the simple-minded hope of one whose family has been too long apart. "I know who you are, Fabula. I doubt you have much changed over the years. I know your cunning and your conviction. I also know that Nessie is at the mercy of her religious voices, and she could slip and undo the terrible good she is helping to create right now by being a focal figure for resistance. If that happens, it will not go well for her."
"So I am to be a whipping girl," thought Elphaba. "I am to be a first line of defense." Her pleasure evaporated.
"And it will not go well for them, the eager supporters," Freck said, waving a hand to indicate most of Munchkinland. His face sagged. His smile was an effort, too, she thought coolly, and his shoulders fell.
"They have had more than a generation of gentle dictatorship from our glorious wizard scoundrel. Oh, even I forget. We're now in the Free State of Munchkinland. These farmers surely underestimate the size of the eventual retaliation. In fact, Shell has found from reliable sources that the stockpiles of grain in the Emerald City are massive, and we can be left for some time without needing to be overrun. Short of routing some divisions of soldiers across the border and jailing some drunken hooligans, this has been a most genteel disengagement so far. We are deluded into believing we are safe. I mean, Nessie is deluded too, I think. You, I have always felt, had a clearer mind about you. You can help her prepare. You can provide the balance and the support."
"I always did that, Papa," she said, "in childhood and at college. Now I am told she can stand up for herself."
"You've heard of my precious shoes," he said. "I bought them from a decrepit crone, and then I retooled them for Nessa with my own hands, using skills in glass and metal that I had once learned from Turtleheart. I made them to give her a sense of beauty, but I didn't expect them to be enchanted by someone else. I am not sorry they are. But Nessa now thinks she needs no one to help her stand or help her govern. She listens less than ever. In some ways, I think those shoes are dangerous."
"I wish you had made them for me, Papa," she said in a quiet voice.
"You didn't need them. You had your voice, your intensity, even your cruelty as your armor."
"My cruelty?" she reared back.
"Oh, you were a fiendish little thing," said Frex. "But so what? Children grow into and out of themselves. You were a terror when you first were around other children. You only calmed down when we began to travel, and you got to hold the baby. It was Nessa Rose who tamed you, you know. You have her to thank. She was holy and blessed, even from the day she was born. Even as an infant, she soothed your wildness with her obvious need. You don't remember that, I suppose."
Elfie wasn't able to remember. She wasn't able to think about all that. Even the idea of being cruel was slipping from her. Instead, she was trying to feel fondness toward her father, despite the exhaustion of being commandeered to be a second lieutenant once again in service of dear, needy Nessa Rose. She concentrated on her father's concern for the citizens of Munchkinland, ever a pastoral sensibility his. Though rejecting his theology, she adored him for his commitment. "I must hear more about Turtle Heart one day," she said in a light voice. "But now I suppose I should go greet my sister. And I will think about what you say, Papa. I can't imagine being part of a governmental troika with you and Nessa Rose, or a committee, should Shell be involved too. But I'll suspend judgment for a while. And Shell, Papa, how is he?"
"Behind enemy lines, so they say," Frex answered, as she got up to leave. "He is a foolhardy boy, and will be among the first casualties once this really gets going. He resembles you in some ways."
"He's gone green?" she asked, amused.
"He's stubborn as sin stains," he answered.
Nessa Rose was secluded in an upstairs parlor, conducting her morning meditation. Frex saw that Elphaba was given license to wander about the house and domain. After all, in another configuration of events, Elphaba could have been, or could yet become, the eminent Throp, the eminence of the East, the nominated head of the Free State of Munchkinland. Frex watched his green daughter amble down marble corridors, dragging her broom like a charwoman, gazing at the ormolu, the damask, the fresh flowers, the servants in livery, the portraits. He felt, as always, a twinge of pain deep in his breast for the hidden and unknowable things that he had done wrong in raising her. But he was glad that she was here at last. Elphaba found her way into a private chapel at the end of a hall of polished mahogany. It was Baroque rather than ancient, and it was in the midst of being redecorated. Nessa Rose must have ordered the frescoes to be whitewashed. Perhaps the succulent images would distract people from their meditative tasks. Elphie sat on a bench on the side, amidst buckets of limestone wash and paintbrushes and ladders. She did not pretend to pray, though she felt very uneasy about this whole thing. She trained her gaze to focus her mind on a huge section still boasting its images. It featured several rotund angels levitating with the aid of sizable wings. Their garments had been cut to accommodate the anatomical irregularity she saw. They were rather full-bodied dames, but the wings weren't bulging with straining arteries nor snapping at the tip. The artist had considered the optimal length and breadth of wing required to hoist ample ladies aloft. The formula looked to be about 3 times wing length to the length of arm, corrected perhaps to account for the portliness. If you could sweep your way to the other land on wings, what about on a broom, she wondered, and realized she must be very tired. Usually she'd cut off senseless speculation about unionist nonsense, like an afterlife, a beyond, an other land. "I should remember my lessons from that life sciences course," she thought, all the devastating borders of knowledge Dr. Dillamond was about to cross. "I almost understood some of it. I could stitch wings onto Chistery. He could join me in flight. What a lark." She rose and went to find her sister. Nessa Rose was less surprised to see Elphaba than Elphie would have guessed. Perhaps, Elphie considered, it was because Nessa had become used to being the center of attention. Then again, she had always been the center of attention.
"Darling Elphie," she said, looking up from a pair of identical books some attendant had laid out next to each other, so she could read 4 pages without calling for someone to turn the page. "Give us a kiss."
"Oh, there then," Elphie said, obliging. "How are you, Nessie? You look fine." Nessa Rose stood in her beautiful shoes and smiled brilliantly.
"The grace of the unnamed God gives me strength as ever," she said.
But Elphaba could not be annoyed. "You have risen, and I don't just mean to your feet," she said. "History has chosen you for a role, and you've accepted it. I'm proud of you."
"You needn't be proud," said Nessa Rose, "but thank you, dear. I thought you'd probably come. Did Father drag you here to take care of me?"
"No one dragged me here, but Papa did right."
"So all those years in solitude and political turmoil brings you out at last. Where were you?"
"Here and there."
"You know we thought you died," said Nessa Rose. "Drape that shawl around my shoulders and fix it with a pin, will you, so I needn't call a maid. I mean that awful, awful time when you left me alone in Shiz. I am still furious with you about it. I just remembered."
She curled her lip prettily. Elphaba was glad to see she possessed at least a residual sense of humor.
"We were all young then, and perhaps I was wrong," said Elfie. "It didn't do you any lasting harm, anyway, at least not so I can see."
"I had to put up with Madame Morrible all by myself for 2 more years. Glinda was a help for a while, then she graduated and went on. Nanny was my salvation, but she was old even then. She's gone on to you lately, hasn't she?"
"Well, back then I felt horribly alone. Only my faith saw me through."
"Well, faith will do that," said Elfie, "if you've got it."
"You speak as one still living in the shadowland of doubt."
"In fact, I think we have more important things to discuss than the state of my soul, or lack thereof. You have a revolution on your hands. Sorry, I guess I've gotten out of the habit. And you're the resident commander-general. Congratulations."
"Oh, tiresome events of the distracting world, yes, yes," said Nessa Rose.
"Look, it's just beautiful out there in the gardens. Let's go walk for a bit and get some air. You look green about the gills."
"All right, I deserve that.
And there's plenty of time to go into diplomatic matters. I have a meeting in a little while, but there's time for a stroll. You should get to know this place. Let me show it to you."
Elphaba could only get Nessa Rose's attention for small snatches of time. However dismissive of the demands of leadership, Nessa Rose was clear-headed about her schedule and spent hours preparing for meetings. And at first, the discussion was frivolous. Family memories, school days. Elfie was impatient to get around to the meat of the matter here, but Nessa Rose wouldn't be rushed. Sometimes she let Elfie sit in when she held audiences with citizens. Elfie wasn't entirely pleased with what she saw. One afternoon, an old woman from some hamlet in the corn basket came in. She made obeisance in a most disgusting and obsequious manner, and Nessa Rose seemed to shine back at her with glory. The woman complained that she had a maid who, having fallen in love with a woodcutter, wanted to leave her service to get married. But the old woman had already given 3 sons to the new local militia for defense, and she and the maid were all the labor available to bring in the crops. If the maid ran off with her woodcutter, the crops would spoil and she would be ruined. "And all for the sake of liberty," she concluded bitterly.
"Well, what do you want me to do about it?" said the Eminence of the East.
"I can give you 2 sheep and a cow," said the woman.
"I have livestock," said Nessa Rose, but Elphaba interrupted and said,
"Did you say sheep? A cow? You mean animals?" "My very own animals," the woman replied proudly. "How do you come to own animals?" Elphaba asked, her teeth clenched. "Are animals no more than chattel now in Munchkin Land?"
"Elfie, please," said Nessa Rose quietly.
"What will you take to release them?" demanded Elfie in a passion. "I already said, do something about this woodcutter."
"What do you have in mind?" interrupted Nessa Rose, displeased that her sister was usurping her role as arbiter of justice.
"I brought you his axe. I thought you might bewitch it and cause it to kill him."
"Fie," said Elphaba, but Nessa Rose said,
"Oh, well, that wouldn't be very nice."
"Very nice," Elfie said. "No, indeed, it wouldn't be very nice, Nessie."
"Well, you're the legal answer around here," said the old woman stoutly. "What do you suggest?"
"I might bewitch his axe and let it slip," said Nessa Rose thoughtfully. "Just enough, perhaps, to cut off his arm. I know from experience that a person without an arm isn't as desirable to the opposite sex as one fully armed."
"Fair enough," said the woman. "But if it doesn't work, I'll come back and you'll do more for the same price. Sheep and a cow don't come cheap around here, you know."
"Nessa Rose, you're not a witch." "No, I don't believe it," said Elfie. "You don't do spells, of all things." "The righteous person can work miracles in the honor of the unnamed God," said Nessa Rose calmly. "Show me that axe if you've brought it."
The old woman held forward a woodcutter's axe, and Nessa Rose knelt down near it as if she were praying. It was an odd, even a frightening thing, to see that narrow, armless body able to lean forward, unaided and off balance, and then, when the spell was through, able to right itself. "Those are some shoes," thought Elfie soberly, bitterly. "Glinda has got some power in her, for all her social dazzle, or maybe the power comes from the love of our father for his Nessie, or some combination. And if Nessa Rose isn't pulling the wool over this old biddy's eyes, she's become a sorceress, too, by whatever name she chooses to call it."
"You are a witch," said Elphaba again. She couldn't help it.
This, perhaps, was a mistake, as the old woman was just thanking Nessa Rose for her efforts.
"I'll bring the animals by the barn out back," she said. "They're tethered in town."
"Animals? Tethered?" exclaimed Elfie, seething.
"Thank you, Miss Eminence," said the old woman. "The Eminence of the East. Or should I call you the Witch of the East?"
She grinned toothily, having gotten her way, and went out the door carrying the enchanted axe over her shoulder, the way a strapping young lumberjack would do. They weren't to be alone again for a while. Elphaba went prowling around the stable and sheds until she found an attendant who could point her toward the two sheep and the cow. They were in a pen with clean straw, each one facing a different corner, chewing in abstraction.
"You're the new animals, brought here by that old vengeful fiend," said Elphaba.
The cow looked over, as if unaccustomed to being addressed. The sheep made no sign of having understood.
"What's your beef?"
said the cow, in a dark humor.
"I've been living in the Vincas," said Elfie. "There aren't many animals there. At one time I was an agitator in the animal rights grassroots sweep. I don't really know how things stand for Munchkinlander animals now. What can you tell me?"
"I can tell you to mind your own business," said the cow.
"And the sheep?"
"These sheep can tell you nothing. They've gone dumb."
"Are they sheep? Does that happen?"
"They talk about humans becoming vegetables, or nuts, or even fruits," said the cow. "But they don't mean it literally. Sheep don't become sheep, they become mute sheep. They don't really need to be discussed here, as if they're not listening, by the way."
"Of course. My apologies," she said to the sheep, one of whom blinked balefully. To the cow, she added, "I'd rather call you by your name."
"I've given up using my name in public," said the cow.
It's not afforded me any individual rights to have an individual name. I reserve it for my private use."
"I understand that," said Elphaba. "I feel the same. I'm just the witch now."
"Her Eminence herself..." A gummy rope of spittle dropped from the cow's jaw. "I'm flattered. I didn't know you called yourself witch. I thought that was just a nasty backfield nickname. The Witch of the East."
"Well, no, I'm her sister. I suppose I'm the Witch of the West, if you will," she grinned. "In fact, I didn't know she was so disliked."
The cow had blundered. "Surely I meant no disregard to your family," she said. "I should just keep my mouth closed and concentrate on my cud. The thing is, I'm in shock. To be sold in exchange for a witch's spell. There's nothing wrong with that woodcutter. Oh, I've got ears, I have, though they forget. And the thought of a warm-hearted simpleton like Nick Chopper coming to harm through a witch's spell, and I part of the barter cost, well, it's hard to imagine how much lower one could sink in life."
"I've come to free you," Elfie said.
"By whose authority?" The cow snorted suspiciously.
"I told you I'm the sister of the Eminent Throp, the Eminence of the East." She amended herself. "The Witch of the East. It's my prerogative here."
"And free to go where? To do what?" said the cow. "We get from here to Lower Muckslop and be roped in again, subjected to slavery under the wizard and catechisms under the Eminent Throp. We don't exactly blend in with those creepy little Munchkinlander humans."
"You've gone a bit dour," said Elphaba.
"Haven't you ever heard of the mad cow?" she answered. "Sweetheart, my udder is sore from their daily yanking. I am tapped for milk morning and night. I won't even go into what it's like to be mounted by a... well, just never mind. But worst, my children have been fattened on milk and slaughtered for veal. I could hear their cries from the abattoir. They didn't even bother to move me out of hearing range." Here she turned her head to the wall, and the sheep came up on either side of her, pressing like a living pair of warm bookends against her lower sides and underbelly. Elphaba said, "I can't be sorrier or more ashamed. Look, I was working with Dr. Dillamond. Have you heard of him? In Shiz, years ago. I went to the wizard himself to protest what was happening."
"Oh, the wizard doesn't show himself to the likes of us," said the cow, after she had regained her composure. "I don't feel like talking any more. Everybody's on your side until they want something from you. The Eminent Nessa Rose has probably brought us in order to impress us into some religious ceremonial procession. My silken flanks tarted up with garlands or the like. And we all know what happens next."
"Now you must be wrong in that," said the witch. "I do object. Nessa Rose is a strict unionist. They don't go in for blood sacrifice."
"Times change," said the cow, "and she's got a population of ill-educated, nervous subjects to pacify. What, pray tell, works better than ritual slaughter?"
"But however could it come to this?" said the witch. "Assuming you're telling the truth. This is farming country. You ought to be well established here."
"Animals in pens have lots of time to develop theories," said the cow. "I've heard more than one clever creature draw a connection between the rise of TikTokism and the erosion of traditional animal labor. We weren't beasts of burden, but we were good, reliable laborers. If we were made redundant in the workforce, it was only a matter of time before we'd be socially redundant, too.
Anyway, that's one theory. My own feeling is that there is real evil abroad in the land. The wizard sets the standard for it, and the society follows suit like a bunch of sheep. Forgive the slanderous reference, she said, nodding to her companions in the pen. It was a slip.
Elphaba threw open the gate of the pen. Come on, you're free, she said. What you make of it is your own affair. If you turn it down, it's on your own heads.
It's on our own heads if we walk out, too. Do you think a witch who would charm an axe to dismember a human being would pause over a couple of sheep and an annoying old cow?
But this might be your only chance, Elphaba cried. The cow moved out, and the sheep followed.
We'll be back, she said. This is an exercise in your education, not ours. Mark my words, my rump'll be served up rare on your finest Dixie House porcelain dinner plates before the year is out. She mooed a last remark. I hope you choke. And tail swishing the flies, she meandered away.
An ambassador from the Glickus, darling, Nessa Rose said, when Elphaba demanded a meeting. Really, I can't turn her away. She's come to discuss mutual defense pacts in the event that the Glickus secedes next. She thinks there are agents trailing her family, and she needs to leave on her return journey tonight. But we'll dine together just like old times, you, me, and my server.
Elphaba had no choice but to while away another afternoon. She located Frex and persuaded him to go for a stroll out beyond the ornamental ponds and pristine lawns, where the woods came up to the back edge of Colwyn grounds. He walked so stiffly, so slowly, it was torture. She was a strider, but she kept herself in check.
"How do you find your sister?" he asked her. After all these years, much changed.
She was always confident in her way, Elphi said reservedly.
I never thought so, and I don't now, Frex said. But I think it was a good act, and it's gotten better.
What really did you ask me to come here for, Papa? Elphaba said. I haven't much time, you know. You must be frank.
You would make a smarter eminence than Nessie, he said. And it's your birthright. Yes, I know the strict rules of title inheritance weren't important to your mother. I just think that the people of Munchkinland would do better with you at the helm. Nessa is too devout, if such a thing exists. Too devout to be a central figure in public life, anyway.
This may be the only respect in which I take after my mother, Elphaba said. But an inherited position is of no interest to me, and it carries no weight at all that I'm the rightful eminence. I've long ago abdicated my position in the family in that respect. Nessa Rose has every right to abdicate hers, and then Shell can be located to stand in. Or better yet, the foolish custom can be abolished and let the Munchkinlanders govern themselves to death.
Nobody ever suggested a leader isn't just as much a scapegoat as a lowly peon, said Frex. Anyway, it's possible. But I'm talking about leadership, not about rank and privilege. I'm talking about the nature of the times we live in, and the job that needs to be done. Fabula, you were always the more capable sibling. Shell is a madcap cut-up, currently playing secret agent. And Nessie is a bruised little girl.
Oh, please, she said in disgust. Isn't it time to get over that?
She hasn't, he said, hurt. Do you see her wrapped in some lover's arms? Do you see her bearing her own children, engaging in life in a way that makes sense? She hides behind her devotion the way a terrorist hides behind his ideals. He saw her flinch at this.
and paused. "I have known terrorists capable of love," she said evenly. "And I have known good Monts, unmarried and childless, doing charity for stricken people."
"Have you known Nessa to have an adult bond with anyone other than the unnamed God?"
"You're one to talk," she said. "You had your wife and your children, but they came lower on the order of priorities than quadlings waiting to be converted."
"I did what had to be done," he said rigidly. "I won't be lectured by my daughter."
"Well, I won't be lectured by you about my everlasting duties to Nessie. I gave her my childhood. I got her going at Shiz. She's made her life the way she wants it, and she still has choice and free will even now. And so do her subjects, who can depose her and cut off her head if her prayers get in their way."
"She is a rather powerful woman," Freck said sadly.
Elfie glanced sideways at him, and for the first time she saw him as feckless, the kind of old man that Irgi, if he survived, would grow to be, constantly pawing at the edge of events, reacting instead of acting, mourning the past and praying for the future instead of stirring up the present.
"How did she get so powerful?" she asked, trying to be kind. "She had two good parents."
He didn't answer this.
They walked on and came out of the woods along the edge of a cornfield. A couple of farmhands were repairing a fence and erecting a scarecrow.
"Afternoon, Brother Frexbar," they said, doffing their caps.
They looked a little askance at Elphaba. When she and her father had continued out of earshot, she said,
"They were wearing a little talisman or something on their tunics. Did you see it? It looked like a small straw dolly or something."
"Oh, yes. The straw man," he sighed. "Another pagan custom that had almost gone underground, and then was revived during the great drought. Ignorant field workers wear a straw man as a charm against the pests of crops, drought, crows, insects, rot. Once upon a time, there was a tradition of human sacrifice about it."
He paused to catch his breath and wipe his face.
"Our family friend, Turtleheart, the quadling, he was butchered right here in Colwyn Grounds, on the day that Nessa Rose was born. An itinerant dwarf and a huge tick-tock entertaining clock were making the circuit that year, and providing a conduit for the ugliest of human inclinations. We arrived here just in time for Turtleheart to be nabbed. I've never forgiven myself for not seeing what was about to happen. But your mother was in her labor, and we'd been run out of town. I wasn't thinking clearly enough all the way around things." Elphaba had heard all this before. Even so,
"You were in love with him," she said,
to make it easier.
"We both were. We shared him," said Frex. "Your mother and I did. It was a lifetime ago, and I don't know why anymore. I don't think I knew why then. I haven't loved anyone else since your mother died, except, of course, my children."
"What a brutal history of sacrifices," she said. "I was just talking to a cow who expects to be a blood victim. Is that possible?"
"The more civilized we become, the more horrendous our entertainments," said Frex.
"And it'll never change, or will it? I remember the etymology of the word Oz, at least as proposed at a lecture by our head, Madame Morrible. She said that academics were inclined to locate the root of the term in the Gilliconese cognate Oos, which carries freights of meaning about growth, development, power, generation. Even Ooze, with its distant companion noun virus, is thought to belong to the same general family. The older I get, the more accurate this derivation seems to be.
and yet the poet of the Osiad calls it land of green abandon, land in endless leaf.
Poets are just as responsible for empire building as any other professional hacks.
Sometimes I would give anything to get away from here, but I dread the thought of a trip across the deadly sands.
That's only a legend, said Elfie. Papa, you taught me that the sands are no more deadly than these fields. That reminds me of the other theory, that Oz is related to the word oasis. What the nomadic peoples of the north thought of Gilliken, time beyond thinking, when Oz was first discovered and settled. Now look, Papa, you needn't go so far. The Vincus is nearly another country. Why don't you come back with me?
I would love to, honey, he said. But how could I leave Nessa Rose? I never could.
Even if she's Turtleheart's daughter and not yours, she said stingingly, because stung.
Especially if that, he answered.
And Elphaba saw that by not knowing for sure if Nessa Rose had been fathered by himself or by Turtleheart, Frex had decided in some sub-rational way that she was the daughter of them both. Nessa Rose was the proof of their brief union. Theirs, and obviously Melina's as well. It didn't matter how crippled Nessa Rose was. She would always be more than Elphaba. Always. She would always mean more. Elphaba and Nessa Rose sat in Nessa's bedchamber. A handmaid served some soup made of cow's stomach. Elfie, not normally squeamish, couldn't eat it. The maid neatly spooned tiny portions into Nessie's mouth. "I'm not going to beat around the bush," Nessa Rose said. I would like you to join me here as a sister-at-arms to lead my circle of advisers and to manage in my absence if I should travel. I have no love of Munchkin Land from what I've seen so far, said Elphaba. The people are cruel and impressed by charades. The pomp of this place is oppressive, and I do believe you're sitting on a powder keg.
All the more reason you should stay and help me, said Nessa Rose. Weren't we raised up to expect a life of service?
Your shoes have made you strong, said Elfie. I didn't know shoes could do that. I don't think you need me. Don't lose those shoes, though.
She thought, your shoes give you an unnatural balance. You look like a serpent standing on its tail.
Surely you remember them from before?
Yes, but I hear Glinda amplified them with a magic spell or something.
Oh, that Glinda, what a card!
Nessie swallowed and smiled.
Well, you can have the shoes, my dear, over my dead body. I'll rewrite my will and leave them to you. Though what they would do for you I can hardly imagine. They didn't grow me new arms. Perhaps enchanted shoes won't change the color of your skin, but will make you enticing enough so that it won't matter.
I'm already too old to be that enticing.
Why, you're still in the prime of life, and so am I, said Nessa Rose, laughing. Tell me you've got some romancing man in a Vincus yurt or tent or teepee or whatever it is they call home there. Come on.
I have been wondering something ever since I saw you do that spell this morning, Elfie said. The spell over the axe.
Oh, right. Small potatoes, that one.
Do you by any chance remember that time in Shiz when Madame Morrible said she was putting us under a spell, and that we couldn't talk to each other about it?
Go on. Sounds familiar. She was so creepy, wasn't she? A master of tyranny.
She said she had chosen us, me, you, and Glinda, to be adepts, to be agents of someone quite high up, to be sorceresses, and, I don't know, secret accomplices. She promised we'd be highly placed and effectual. She made us think we couldn't ever discuss it with one another.
Oh, yes, that I do remember.
What a witch she was.
Well, do you think there's any truth to that? Do you think she had the power to bind us into silence, to make us powerful sorceresses?
She had the power to scare us out of our wits, but we were young and very stupid, as I remember. I had the feeling at the time that she was in collusion with the wizard, and that she ordered her TikTok thing, Grammatic. The name's just come back to me. Isn't memory odd like that? To kill Dr. Dillamond. You saw fiends with knives behind every chair. You always did, Nessa Rose said. I don't think that Madame Morrible had any real power. She was a manipulative woman, but her power was very limited. And in our naivete, we saw her as a villain. She was merely full of self-importance.
I wonder. I tried to say something about it afterward. Didn't we all faint?
We were innocent and horribly suggestible, Elfie.
And Glinda's gone on to marry money, as Madame Morrible said.
Is Sir Chuffrey still alive?
If you can call it that, yes. And Glinda is a sorceress, there's no questioning that. But Madame Morrible was merely predicting things to us. She saw our talents, as an educator could be expected to do, and she advised us on how to make the most of them. What's so surprising about that?
She tried to seduce us into a secret service for an unknown master. I'm not inventing this, Nessie.
She knew how to get to you, obviously, by appealing to your sense of conspiracy. I don't remember such alluring nonsense.
Elphaba fell silent. Perhaps Nessie was right. And yet here they were, a dozen years later, two witches, in a manner of speaking, and Glinda a sorceress for the public good. It was enough to make Elfie go back to Kiamo Ko and burn that grimmery, and burn the broom, too, for that matter.
"She always reminded Glinda of a carp," said Nessa Rose. "Can you really be scared of a fish after all these years?"
"I saw in a book once a drawing of a lake monster, or a sea monster if you believe in oceans," said Elfie. "I may not be sure if monsters exist, but I'd rather live my life in doubt than be persuaded by a real experience of one."
"You said much the same thing about the unnamed god once," said Nessa Rose quietly.
"Oh, now, please don't start on that."
"A soul is too valuable to ignore, Elfie."
"Well, isn't it good I don't have one, then? So there's no muss, no fuss."
"You have a soul. Everyone does."
"How about the cow you bartered for today, and the sheep?"
"I'm not talking about lower orders."
"That sort of talk offends me, Nessie. I freed those animals today, you know."
Nessa Rose shrugged. "You have some rights in Colwyn Grounds. I'm not going to walk around prohibiting your little pet missions."
"They said some pretty horrible things about how animals are being treated here. I thought it was the Emerald City and Gillikin only. I somehow guessed Munchkin Land, being more rural, would have more common sense."
"You know," said Nessie, indicating that the maid should wipe her mouth with a napkin, "once at a prayer service I met a soldier. He had lost a limb in a campaign against some restless quadlings. He said every morning he slapped the stump where his arm used to be. He got the blood ringing, and after a few minutes there was a tingling sensation, and he developed a kind of phantom limb. Not all at once, and not in physical form. What he regained was a sense of what it had felt like. It would grow to the elbow, and then his memory, his bodily memory, of limbs in three-dimensional space, would extend, eventually, all the way down to his fingers. Once his phantom limb was in place, mentally, that is, he could face the day as a crippled man. Furthermore, he had better physical balance."
Elphaba, feeling more and more like a real witch, looked at her sister, waiting for the punch.
"I tried it for a while. For months, in fact. I had Nanny massage my little knobs there. After much hard work on poor Nanny's part, I began to develop just the beginning of a sense of what it would be like to have arms. It never went very far, until Glinda dazzled up these shoes. Now, I don't know why, maybe they're too tight and my circulation is complaining, after an hour on my feet, I have phantom arms. First time in my life. I can't quite get the feel of fingers."
"Phantom limbs," said Elfie. "Well, I'm pleased for you.
You know, if you slapped yourself around, spiritually speaking," said Nessarose, "you might develop a phantom soul, or something that felt like one. It's a good internal guide, a soul. I suspect you might even recognize that it's not a phantom at all. It's a real one."
"That'll do, Nessie," said Elphaba. "I don't care to discuss my spiritual trials with you."
"Why don't you stay here with me, join my staff, and we can have you baptized," said Nessarose warmly.
"Water is profoundly painful to me, as you well know, and I won't discuss it again. I can't pledge allegiance to anything unnamed. It's a sham."
"You're condemning yourself to a life of sadness," Nessarose said.
"Well, that I'm already familiar with, so at least there's nothing to jump out and surprise me." Elfie threw down her napkin. "I can't stay here, Nessie. I can't help you out. I have responsibilities of my own back in the Vincus, which you have shown precious little interest in finding out about." "Oh, all right, I know. A revolution has occurred, and you're a new prime minister or something. You surely have a right to be distracted, if anyone does. Either accept the burden of leadership or turn it down, but either way make sure it's your choice in the matter, and not an accident of history. A martyrdom by default. I worry about you, but I can't stay and be your dog's body."
"I've just been clumsy and outspoken. Don't expect me to remember how to be sisterly in such a short while."
"You've had Shell to practice on all these years," Elphaba said sternly.
"Just like that? You're getting up and going?"
Nessarose stood, too, in that sinuous, unsettling way she had.
"After 12 years of separation, we have 3-4 days of reunion, and that's that?"
"Keep yourself well," Elfie said, and kissed her sister on both cheeks. "I know you'll be a good eminence for as long as you want to be."
"I shall pray for your soul," promised Nessarose.
"I shall wait for your shoes," Elfie answered.
On her way out, Elfie thought about going to say goodbye to her father, and then decided against it. She had said to him everything that she could bring herself to say. They had ganged up on her, in the claustrophobic, loving way of families, and she wanted no more of it. Taking the northern route over the Madeleines, she realized she would pass Lake George. She decided to pause there, about halfway home, interested to note that she was actually glad to be heading back. She paced the edge of the lake, looking for Caprice in the Pines, but she could not pick it out of the many resort villas that had sprung up since that visit in her youth. But it wasn't the visible terrain she was really seeing. It was the world at large, the character it seemed to have, how it seemed to refer to itself. How could Nessarose believe in the unnamed god? Behind every aspect of the world is another aspect of the world. In a sense, wasn't that what Dr. Dillamond had been on about? He had imagined another true foundation of the world, defensible by proofs and experiments. He had figured out how to locate it. But she was not a visionary. Behind the blue and white marbleized paper of the lake,
beyond the watered silk of the sky, Elphaba couldn't see any deeper in. Not about the raw material of life, the muscle structure of angels' wings, the capillary action involved in focusing a gimlet gaze, nor about the gooey subjects of the Empyrean. Not about good, if the unnamed god was good. Not about evil, either. For who was enthralled to whom, really? And could it ever be known? Each agent working in collusion and antagonism, like the cold and the sun alike, creating a deadly spear of ice. Was the wizard a charlatan, a fraud, a despot of merely human power and failure? Did he control the adepts, Nessarose and Glinda, and an unnamed third, for it surely wasn't Elfie? Or was it only put to him by Madame Morrible that he did, to assuage his obvious ego, his appetite for the semblance of power? And Madame Morrible and Yackel, was there any connection? Were they the same person? Were they harsh divinities, avatars of a power of darkness? Were they poisonous flitches struck from the evil body of the Cumbric witch? Or were they, singly or together, old Cumbricia herself, or such as could be presumed to have survived from the heroic age of mythology into these crabbed, cramped modern days? Did they govern the wizard, jerk him about like a marionette? Who is in thrall to whom? And while you wait to learn, the deadly icicle formed by all opposing forces falls and drives its cold nail into penetrable flesh. She left the pine-needled shores of Lake George in a state of high frustration and energy. Having no confidence to decide about matters of political or theological hierarchy, she felt driven to dig up those old notes she had collected from Dr. Dillamon's study the day after he was murdered. Something concrete under her fingertips, a magnifying lens, a surgical knife, a sterilized probe. Perhaps now she was old enough to understand what he had been getting at. He had been a unionist essentialist. She was a novice atheist. But she still might profit from his work after all this time. The winds were with her as far as the lower slopes of the Great Kells. Thereafter, she had a harder time, both finding her way and keeping her seat. A number of times she had to dismount and walk. Fortunately, it wasn't very cold, and she came upon small clusters of nomads in the protected vales, who kept her heading in the right direction. Still, she was 2 weeks returning, even with the help of a broom. Late in the afternoon, with the sun still hot and high compared to its winter habits, she toiled her way up the last slopes, Kiamo Ko raising its narrow dark profile above her. She felt like a child looking up at the top hat of a very tall gentleman. Eager to avoid ceremony and fuss, she skirted the village. Without the broom, this approach would be nearly impossible. As it was, even the broom seemed to be feeling the effort. She came to a halt in the orchard, made her way to the back door and found it open, which meant the sisters were out flower-picking or some such nonsense. The place was quiet. She grabbed a browning apple from the sideboard and trudged up the steps of her tower without running into anyone. When she passed Nanny's room, she rattled the doorknob and said, "Nanny?" "Oh!" came a little shriek. "You startled me!" "May I come in?"
"Just a minute!"
There was the sound of furniture being dragged away from the door.
"Well, this is a fine mess, Miss Elphaba, going off and leaving us to be murdered in our beds, or just as likely. What are you talking about? Let me in." "And not saying a word. You had us frantic with worry.
The last piece scraped across the floor, and Nanny flung open the door.
"You hideous, ungrateful woman!"
She fell heavily into her arms and burst into tears.
"Please, I've had enough drama to last me the rest of my life," said Elphaba. "What are you going on about?"
Nanny took some while to calm down. She rummaged through her bag for some smelling salts, pulling out enough little bottles and satchels to set up her own apothecary business. There were blue glass vials, clear pill boxes, snakeskin envelopes of powders and pills, and a beautiful green glass bottle that had an old torn label on it, Miracle ELI. She administered calming agents to herself, and when she could breathe again, she said,
"Well, you know, my dear, you saw, I suppose, that everyone has disappeared."
Elphaba scowled in confusion and rising sudden fear. Nanny took a deep breath.
"Now don't be angry at Nanny. It's not Nanny's fault. Those soldiers suddenly decided that their exercises were finished. I don't know how. Maybe Nor told them you were gone. She told us. She'd been sneaking around looking for your broom, and she said you weren't here. So maybe she mentioned it to them. You know how nice they were to her, how they adored her. The soldiers came to the front door and said that they needed to escort the entire family, Sarima and her sisters, and Nor and Irji, back to their base camp, wherever it is. They didn't require me, they said, which was very insulting indeed, and I let them know as much. Sarima asked why, and that nice commander, Cherrystone, said that it was for their own protection. In case a fighting battalion comes through, he said, it won't do to have any members of the ruling family still here, or there might be a bloody incident.
Coming through? A battalion? When? Elfie hit the windowsill with her open palm.
I'm trying to tell you. No time soon, he said. This is just advance planning. They became insistent. Those soldiers scattered the peasants in the village. I don't think there was any killing. It all seemed quite humane, except for the chains. And only I was left behind, being too old to march down a mountain, and no relation besides. Also, they left Lear, since he was no threat, and I think they'd become fond of him. But a few days later, Lear disappeared, too. I'm sure he was desperately lonely for them, and he must have followed them to their camp.
And nobody protested? Shrieked Elfie.
Don't yell at me. Of course they protested. Well, Sarima fell in a heap, fainting dead away, and Irji and Nor looked after her. But the sisters, that mealy-mouthed lot, they barricaded the dining room and set fire to the chapel wing, trying to draw attention. And three slammed a sharpening stone on the hand of Commander Cherrystone and broke every bone in his wrist, I bet. Five and six rang the bell, but the shepherds are too far away, and it all happened too fast. Two wrote messages and tried to tie them to the feet of your crows, but they wouldn't be liberated. They just kept roosting on the windowsills again, useless old things. Four had a great idea about boiling oil, but they couldn't get the flame high enough. Oh, it was a merry chase here for a day or two, but of course the soldiers won. Men always win.
Nanny continued petulantly.
And we all thought they'd ambushed you earlier to get you out of the way. You're the only effective one here, everyone knows that. They all think you're a witch. The townspeople told me that if you come back, you're to be in touch with the hamlet of Red Windmill down below the dam. You know the one. They seem to think you can rescue their royal family, such as they are. I told them it was misplaced trust, that you wouldn't be interested. But I promised to give you the message, so there it is.
Elphaba strode back and forth. She pulled her hair from its customary knot and shook it out, as if trying to shake away what she was hearing.
"And Chistery?" she said at last. cowering behind the piano in the music room, no doubt. Well, this is a fine kettle of fish.
She strode, she sat, she stroked her chin. She kicked Nanny's chamber pot and broke it.
What have I got? She mumbled. There's the broom, there's the bees, there's the monkey, there's Killyjoy. Did they hurt Killyjoy? There's Killyjoy, there's the crows, there's Nanny, there's the villagers, if they're unharmed. There's the questionable Grimmery. It's not a lot.
No, it's not, said Nanny, sighing. Doom, doom, I say.
We can get them back, said Elfie. We will.
Count Nanny in, said Nanny, though I never did like those sisters, I'll tell you.
Elfie clenched her fists and tried to keep from striking herself.
Lear gone, too, she said. I came here to make my apologies to Serima, and I lost Lear in the bargain. Am I good for nothing in this life?
Kiamo Ko was deathly still, except for old Nanny's labored breathing as she took a catnap in her rocking chair. Killyjoy thumped his tail on the floor, happy to see his mistress. The sky was broad and hopeless beyond the windows. Elphaba was tired herself, but she couldn't sleep, for from time to time she imagined she could hear the sound of water lapping against the sides of the fish well, as if the legendary underground lake were rising to drown them all.
Part 5. The Murder and Its Afterlife. Afterward, there was a lot of discussion about what people had thought it was. The noise had seemed to come from all corners of the sky at once. Journalists, armed with the thesaurus and apocalyptic scriptures, fumbled and were defeated by it. A gulfy deliquescence of deranged and harnessed air. A volcano of the invisible, darkly construed. To the pleasure-faithers with tick-tock affections, it was the sound of clockworks uncoiling their springs and running down at a terrible speed. It was the release of vengeful energy. To the essentialists, it seemed as if the world had suddenly found itself too crammed with life, with cells splitting by the billions, molecules uncoupling to annihilation, atoms shuddering and juggernauting in their casings. To the superstitious, it was the collapsing of time. It was the oozing of the ills of the world into one crepuscular muscle, intent on stabbing the world to its core for once and for all. To the more traditionally religious, it was the blitzkrieg of vengeful angel armies, the awful name of the unnamed god, sounding itself at last, surprise, and the evaporation of all hopes for mercy. One or two pretended to think it was squadrons of flying dragons overhead, trained for attack, breaking the sky from its moorings by the thrash of tripartite wings. In the wake of the destruction it caused, no one had the hubris or courage, or the prior experience, to lie and claim to have known the act of terror for what it was. A wind twisted up in a vertical braid. In short, a tornado. The lives of many Munchkinlanders were lost, along with square miles of topsoil from hundreds of years of cultivation. The shifting margins of sand in the eastern desert covered several villages without a trace, and no survivors were left to tell the tale of their suffering. Whirling like something from a nightmare, the wind funnel drove into Oz, 30 miles north of Stonespar End, and delicately maneuvered around Colwyn Grounds, leaving every rose petal attached and every thorn in place. The tornado sliced through the corn basket, devastating the basis of the economy of the renegade nation.
and petered out, as if by design, not only at the eastern terminus of the largely defunct yellow brick road, but also at the precise spot, the hamlet of Center Munch, where, outside a local chapel, Nessa Rose was awarding prizes for perfect attendance at religious education classes. The storm dropped a house on her head. All the children survived to pray for Nessa Rose's soul at the memorial service. Perfect attendance was never more perfect. There were a great many jokes about the disaster, naturally. "You can't hide from destiny," some said. "That house had her name on it." That Nessa Rose, she was giving such a good speech about religious lessons, she really brought down the house. Everybody needs to grow up and leave home sometimes, but sometimes home doesn't like it. What's the difference between a shooting star and a falling house? One, which is propitious, grants delicious wishes. The other, which is vicious, squishes witches. What's big, thick, makes the earth move, and wants to have its way with you? I don't know, but can you introduce me? Such a maelstrom had not been known in Oz before. Various terrorist groups claimed credit, especially when news got around that the Wicked Witch of the East, also known as the Eminent Throp, depending on your political stripe, had been snuffed out. It was not widely understood at first that the house carried passengers. The mere presence of a house of exotic design, set down almost intact upon the platform rigged up for the visiting dignitaries, was stretching credulity enough. That creatures might have survived such a fall was either patently unbelievable or a clear indication of the hand of the unnamed god in the affair. Predictably, there were a few blind people who suddenly cried, "I can see!" A lame pig that stood and danced a jig, only to be led away, that sort of thing. The alien girl, she called herself Dorothy, was by virtue of her survival elevated to living sainthood. The dog was merely annoying. When the news of Nessa Rose's premature death arrived at Kiamo Ko by carrier pigeon, the witch was deep in an operation of sorts, stitching the wings of a white-crested male roc into the back muscles of one of her current crop of snow monkeys. She had more or less perfected the procedure, after years of botched and hideous failures, when mercy-killing seemed the only fair thing to do to the suffering subject. Fiyero's old schoolbooks in the life sciences from Dr. Nicodick's course had given some leads. Also, the grimoire had helped, if she was reading it correctly. She had found spells to convince the axial nerves to think skyward instead of treeward. And once she got it right, the winged monkeys seemed happy enough with their lot. She had yet to see a female monkey in her population produce a winged baby, but she still had hopes. Certainly they had taken better to flying than they had to language. Chistery, now a patriarch in the castle menagerie, had plateaued at words of one syllable, and still seemed to have no clear idea of what he was saying. It was Chistery, in fact, who brought the pigeon's letter into Elphaba's operating salon. The witch had him hold the fascia slasher while she unfolded the page. Shell's brief message told of the tornado and informed her of the memorial service, which was scheduled for several weeks later, in the hope that she would receive this message in time to come. She put the message down and went back to work, placing grief and regret away from her. It was a tricky business, wing attachment, and the sedative she had administered to this monkey wouldn't last all morning. "Chistery, it's time to help Nanny down the stairs, and find Lear if you can, and tell him I need to talk to him at lunch." she said through her gritted teeth, glancing again at her own diagrams to make sure she had the overlapping of muscle groups in the correct arrangement, front to back. It was an achievement if Nanny could now make it to the dining room once a day. "That's my job, that and sleeping, and Nanny does both very well," she said every single noontime when she arrived, hungry from her exertions on the stairs. Lear put out the cheese and bread and the occasional cold joint, at which the three of them hacked and nibbled, usually in an unsocial mood, before darting off to their afternoon chores. Lear was 14, and insisted he was going to accompany the witch to Colwyn Grounds. "I have never been anywhere except that time with the soldiers," he complained. "You never let me do anything." "Someone has to stay and take care of Nanny," said the witch. "Now there isn't any point in arguing about it."
"Chistery can do it."
"Chistery can't. He's getting forgetful. And between him and Nanny, they'd burn the place to the ground. No, there's no more discussion about it, Lear. You're not going. Besides, I'm going to have to travel on my broom, I think, to get there in time."
"You never let me do anything."
"You can do the washing up."
"You know what I mean."
"What's he arguing about now, sweet thing?" asked Nanny loudly.
"Nothing," said the witch.
"What's that you say?"
"Nothing."
"Aren't you going to tell her?" said Lear. "She helped raise Nessa Rose, didn't she?"
"She's too old. She doesn't need to know. She's 85. It'll only upset her."
"Nanny," said Lear, "Nessie's dead."
"Hush, you useless boy, before I remove your testicles with my foot."
"Nessie did what?"
screeched Nanny, looking roomily out at them.
"Did, died, dead," intoned Chistery.
"Did what?"
"Nessie died," said Lear.
Nanny began to weep at the idea before she had even confirmed it.
"Can this be true, Elfie? Is your sister dead?"
"Lear, you'll answer for this," said the witch. "Yes, Nanny, I cannot lie to you. There was a storm and a building collapsed. She went very peacefully, they say."
"She went straight to the bosom of Lurlina," said Nanny, sobbing. "Lurlina's golden chariot came to take her home."
She patted the piece of cheese on her plate inexplicably. Then she buttered a napkin and took a bite.
"When do we leave for the funeral?"
"You're too old to travel, dear. I'm going in a few days. Lear will stay and look after you."
"I will not," said Lear.
"He's a good boy," said Nanny.
"But not as good as Nessa Rose. Oh, sorrowful day. Lear, I'll take my tea in my room. I can't sit and talk to you as if nothing's happened."
She hauled herself to her feet, leaning on Chistery's head. Chistery was devoted to her.
"You know, darling," she said to the witch, "I don't think the boy is old enough to see to my needs. What if the castle is attacked again? Remember what happened the last time you went away."
She made a small accusatory moo. "Nanny, the Arjiki militia guard this place day and night. The wizard's army is well housed in the town of Red Windmill down below. They have no intention of leaving that safe haven and risking decimation in these mountain passes, not after what they did. That was their skirmish. That was their campaign. Now they're just watchdogs. They staff the outpost to report signs of an invasion or trouble from the mountain clans. You know that. You have nothing to fear."
"I'm too old to be taken in chains like poor Sarima and her family," Nanny said. "And how could you rescue me if you couldn't get them back?"
"I'm still working on that," said the witch into Nanny's left ear.
7 years! You're very stubborn.
It's my opinion they're all moldering in a common grave these 7 long years. Lear, you have to thank Lurlina that you weren't among them.
I tried to rescue them, said Lear stubbornly, who had rewritten the escapade in his own mind to give himself a more heroic role. It was not longing for the companionship of soldiers, he told himself. No, it was a courageous effort to save the family. In fact, Commander Cherrystone, out of kindness, had had Lear tied up and left him in a sack in someone's barn to prevent their having to incarcerate him with the others. The commander had not realized Lear was a bastard son of Fiero, for Lear himself didn't know it.
"Yes, well, that's a good boy."
Nanny was now distracted from the sad news, drifting back to the tragedy she remembered more viscerally.
"Of course, I did everything I could, but Nanny was an old woman even then. Elfie, do you think they're dead?"
"I could find out nothing," said the witch, for the 10,000th time. "If they were spirited to the Emerald City, or if they were murdered, I could not tell. You know this, Nanny. I bribed people. I spied around. I hired agents to follow every lead. I wrote to the Princess Nastoya of the Scrow for advice. I spent a year following every useless clue. You know this. Don't torture me with the memory of my failure."
"It was my failure, I'm sure," said Nanny peacefully.
They all knew she didn't think so for a minute.
"I should have been younger and more vigorous. I'd have given that Commander Cherrystone a piece of my mind. And now Sarima is gone, gone, and her sisters too. I suppose it's none of our fault, really," she concluded disingenuously, scowling at the witch. "You had some place to go, so you went. Who can criticize you for that?"
But the image of Sarima in chains, Sarima as a decaying corpse, still withholding from the witch her forgiveness for Fiero's death, it pained her like water.
"Give up, you old harridan," said the witch. "Must my own household whip me so? Go have your tea, you fiend."
The witch sat down at last and thought of Nessarose and what might come. The witch had tried to stay removed from the affairs of the political world, but she knew a change of leadership in Munchkinland could throw things out of balance, maybe to a positive effect. She felt a guilty lightness at the death of her sister. She made a list of things to bring with her to the memorial service. Foremost was a page of the Grimoire. In her chamber she pored over the huge musty tome, and finally she ripped out an especially cryptic page. Its letters still continued to contort beneath her eyes, sometimes scrambling and unscrambling as she looked, as if they were formed by a colony of ants. Whenever she gazed at the book, meaning might emerge on a page that a day earlier had been illegible chicken scratches, and meaning sometimes disappeared as she stared. She would ask her father, who with his holy eyes would see the truth better. Colwyn Grounds was draped in black swags and purple bunting. When the witch arrived, she was greeted by a one-man-less-than-welcoming committee, a bearded Munchkinlander named Nip, who seemed to be concierge, janitor, and acting prime minister. "Your lineage no longer allows you any particular liberties in Munchkinland," she was told. "With the death of Nessarose, the honorific of eminence is at last abolished." The witch didn't much care, but she wasn't inclined to accept a unilateral dictum without a retort. She answered, "It is abolished when I accept that it is abolished." Not that the honorific had been used much in recent years. According to the occasional rambling letter from Frex, Nessarose had begun to be amused by the slur of Wicked Witch of the East,
and had considered it a public penance worthy of a person with such high moral standing. She even took to referring to herself as such. Nip showed her to her room. "I don't need much," said the Wicked Witch of the West, as in contrast she allowed herself to be called, at least by these Munchkinlander upstarts. "A bed for a couple of days, and I'd like to see my father and attend the service. I'll collect a few things and be off soon. Now, do you know if our brother Shell will be here?" "Shell has disappeared again," said Nip. "He left his regards. There is a mission he is undertaking in the Glickus. It can't wait. Some of us think he is defecting, worried about a change in government here now that the tyrant is dead. As well he might," he added coldly. "Have you fresh towels?" "I don't use them," said the witch. "It's all right. Go away now." She was very tired and sad. At 63, Frex was even bolder and his beard whiter than he had been last time. His shoulders hunched in as if trying to meet each other. His head sank into a natural cavity made by a deteriorating spine and neck. He sat covered by a blanket on the veranda. "And who is this?" he said, when the witch came up and sat next to him. She realized his sight had nearly gone for good. "It is your other daughter, Papa," she said, "the one that's left." "Fabula," he said, "what will I do without my pretty Nessa Rose? How will I live without my pet?" She held his hand until he fell asleep and wiped his face, though his tears burned her skin. The liberated Munchkinlanders were destroying the house. The witch had no use for frippery, but it seemed a shame to waste a property this way. Desecration was so short-sighted. Didn't they know that, however they now decided to live, Colwyn Grounds could be their Parliament building? She spent time with her father, but they didn't speak much. One morning, when he was more alert and energetic than usual, he asked her if she really was a witch. "Oh, well, what's a witch? Who has ever trusted language in this family?" she replied. "Father, will you look at something for me? Will you tell me what you see?" She withdrew from an inner pocket the page from the Grimoire, and she unfolded it like a large napkin on his lap. He ran his hands over it, as if he could pick up meaning through his fingertips, and then held it near, peering and squinting. "What do you see?" she asked. "Can you tell me the nature of this writing? Is it for good or for ill?"
"The markings are crisp enough and large. I ought to be able to make it out." He turned it upside down. "But little Fabula, I can't read this alphabet. It is in a foreign tongue. Can you?"
"Well, sometimes I seem to..."